Hello, everybody. We're going to be starting the second lecture today now. As you remember, there's a problem we have in trying to cover Volume 1 of Rothbard's History of Economic Thought in 6 lectures. There's an enormous amount of material in the book, as you will have gathered if you've done the reading. In each chapter, Rothbard discusses scores of different people. So we have a problem. How do we know what to cover? So the reason I decided to give a lecture on the late Spanish scholastics is that Rothbard thought these people, these late Spanish scholastics, were extremely important in the development of economics. These were not just minor figures, these are major people. Now, why does he think that? Why are the Spanish scholastics so important? Well, remember from the last time, I mentioned that Rothbard is concerned in the book to construct a counter narrative to the picture, very common picture of economics. So, economics begins with Adam Smith, Wealth of Nations, 1776. Then after that, we have various British economists, like especially David Ricardo and John Stuart Mill later, and then we have Alfred Marshall, the marginalists, Menger, Jevons, and Walras. Then we have in the 20th century, have more Keynes and others. So there's kind of a view of economics. We have a few great men. There are a few women, famous women economists like Joan Robinson, and most of the great economists are men. So you have this picture. Economics starts in 1776, and it goes on from there through a few great men. Now Rothbard rejects that. He said economics didn't begin with Adam Smith, and he views Smith as kind as not as advancing economic the path of economic progress of economic theory, but he views him as a regress. So he has a completely different view. And the dominant theme, the way he organizes this different view, is he says there's a struggle in the history of economics between economists who say that the value of goods, the subjective value of goods, say, how do we know what the value of any good is? That depends on people's preferences for the good. So when we're trying to explain prices, what we're ultimately going to be reducing the price, the causal explanation of prices, will be in the subjective preferences of the buyers and sellers of the goods. So Rothbard says there's this account of views that stress the subjective nature of value, and then opposed to them are cost of production theories that say, for example, the value of good is how much labor time is required to produce it. So the basic theme of Rothbard's History of Economics is that there's a struggle between the views that stress subjective nature of value, which he thinks is the correct view, and other views, such as the views of Smith and Ricardo, Karl Marx, that say stress cost of production theory. So since the cost of production theories were sometimes the dominant theories, it's false to say that the progress of economic theory has been continuously higher. So he's rejecting what I called the last time, using the famous phrase of Herbert Butterfield, a Whig interpretation of science. The Whig interpretation would be everything in science is getting, we're constantly getting to know more and more. Science is always progressive. So Rothbard said, no, that's not true, because sometimes economics is progressing, namely when the subjective theory of value is being developed, and sometimes it's not. Sometimes there are regresses along the way, namely when these cost of production theories come in. So Rothbard's narrative then is not one of continual upward progress. It's progress that's interrupted by these counter movements where cost of production theory goes in. I remember just one more point reviewing from last time. I contended that although Rothbard was rejecting the Whig interpretation of science, and said things aren't getting better and better all the time, and although he was influenced a good deal by the famous book of Thomas Kuhn, Structure of Scientific Revolutions, came out in 1962, where Kuhn would say science proceeds by one paradigm or one kind of dominant theory replacing another. He said it's not that people just keep the same framework and then keep adding more and more improvements to it. Like, well, one basic framework is replaced by another. So Rothbard agrees with that to some extent, but there's one way, and I think it's a significant way, that Rothbard himself does have a progressivist or Whig aspect to his own account. And that aspect is this. Rothbard thinks that there's a definite truth in economics, namely economics as taught by the Austrian school, especially developed by Ludwig von Mises. So what he's interested in is tracing how economic theory has progressed so it's reached the correct views, namely the views held by the Austrians. So in that sense, he does have a view where he's looking for what leads up to the present, sort of saying, how did the correct insights, namely the ones we have now in Austrian economics, how did people come to achieve those insights? So see, that is a progressivist Whig view of things. He definitely wouldn't accept the view that some followers of Kuhn and possibly Kuhn himself held, namely that you can't compare theories that use different frameworks or paradigms. So on that kind of view, she said, well, the cost of production theory would be asking completely different questions, say, from modern subjectivist theories, and you can't really compare one with the other, say that one is better, they're just answering different problems. Rothbard wouldn't accept that. He'd say, no, the cost of production theories are just wrong. So you could say, if you dropped out all the cost of production theories from his narrative, then there would be a Whig view, namely you'd have the development of the subjectivist theory, the correct view. So his view is rejecting certain aspects of a Whig interpretation because he puts in there periods where there is regression, where science isn't progressing, but he's not really a radical opponent of a Whig interpretation in the sense that he does think there is such a thing as progress in an absolute sense, because it is progress toward the correct views, namely the Austrian view that we have developed in the views of in the work of Mises and also in its own work. Now, the Spanish scholastics of the 16th and early 17th century were censored at the University of Salamanca in Spain are extremely important in Rothbard's narrative. Because remember, what Rothbard is trying to do in this account of economics is show how these insights of the Austrian school developed, and also how they were, these insights were derailed by these other theories, cost reduction theories. So the people, the scholastics, the University of Salamanca developed some of the most important insights of the Austrian school, so that's why they're especially important. Now, all of the persons were discussed in this chapter are called scholastics. I'm sure you've heard the term scholastic, the scholastics or the philosophy of the schools. I see the question, are we skipping Erasmi and Bodin? We'll be discussing Bergen. Yes, I mean, like I said, we couldn't cover everything there in the earlier Middle Ages, so we're not going to be doing those. As I said, we're just dealing with, we can't cover everything, or at least I can't, but those are certainly interesting people. But what are we doing in scholastic philosophy? What do we mean by scholastic philosophy? Well, it's a bit different from what you would get in contemporary philosophy. Say, in contemporary philosophy, say you have a certain problem like, what are the conditions for knowledge? If you say read an article, people will try to come up with arguments on, like, they'll say, well, the conditions for saying that someone knows something or such and such. Of course, there are very frequently a lot of references to what previous philosophers have said on it. But the main point in current philosophy is the philosophers will be trying to just develop arguments that they think are correct ones. Now, scholastic philosophy isn't like that. The general way a scholastic philosopher will proceed will be by commenting on other texts. Say someone will do a commentary on Aristotle's Ethics, or a commentary on the sentences of Peter Lombard. And all the points that they make, they'll have a lot of arguments, but they'll come in as comments on previous writers. And even in a text that isn't a commentary, they'll almost always be a summary of what previous writers have said. For example, if you look at the most famous work of scholastic philosophy, the Summa Theologica of St. Thomas Aquinas, what you have there is, when he gives a certain question, you will first give a lot of objections to the view that he's going to defend, and he'll make a lot of references to people who raise these objections, then he'll give his own thesis and then reply to all the objections. So if you read him in the Summa, he's really summing up what everybody else has said on the topic that he's considering. So this is the way scholastic philosophy works. It's commenting on, it doesn't usually just advance an argument kind of out of the blue, just say, here's the solution I've come up with to this important question in economics or philosophy. There'll be comments on previous works. Now, before Rothbard gets to the School of Salamanca in his chapter, he discusses a very interesting figure, the Italian Dominican Thomas de Vio, Cardinal Cajetan, who lived from 1468 to 1534. And Cajetan was a Dominican. He became the general of the Dominican order. That means the one who's the commander, the one who's in charge of the order. Like the Jesuits have a general in the order, and various orders will have their own leader. So Cajetan was the leader of the Dominican. He was also famous for debating with Martin Luther. When Martin Luther was first rebelling against the papacy, he hadn't broken yet, fully broken with the Catholic Church. But the Pope sent Cardinal Cajetan to try to convince Luther that he was wrong and should return to the obedience of the papacy. He wasn't successful, but he was renowned for his argumentative skills. And he's most famous in philosophy for his views on what's called analogical predication. One thing, a very basic theme that Aquinas had is, say, supposing we're talking about we have certain predicates that apply to God. So we say God is great, or God knows everything. We have, when we apply a predicate to God, it doesn't have exactly the same meaning as it does, say, if we would apply the same predicate to human beings. We say something like human beings are wise. Wise doesn't mean exactly the same thing as it does when we say God is wise. But it isn't, and it doesn't mean that they're not, terms aren't absolutely different either. So they have something in common and something different. So Aquinas said the terms there are analogical. They're predicated analogically. And Cajetan was very famous for his own work kind of systematizing what Aquinas had said on analogical predication. And this was in, as you would expect from what I've said in the previous slide, this was in a commentary on St. Thomas Aquinas' Summa Theologica. So he gave, and his views on predication were extremely important, although they were questioned by some people, like some Thomas said, no, Cajetan has gotten this all wrong about Aquinas didn't mean it by analogy what Cajetan said, but others said, no, he was right about it. That was what he was most famous for. Now, as far as economics is concerned, Cajetan had a favorable attitude to business. Now, in the Middle Ages, as you know, probably know those of you who studied feudalism, people were born into a certain station in life. Say you would be born a noble or a serf or say someone from a merchant family or someone from a craftsman family. And once you were born in this status or estate, it was very difficult for people to get out of it. You know, we have the idea now, say someone who's born poor can work hard and get to be rich, if possibly you're not fixed by where you were born. But in the Middle Ages, it was more of a view, it wasn't absolutely always true, that you should stay in the station that you've been born to. People had fixed places in society. One probably main exception to that was, say, very talented people could enter the church and then they could rise to high positions in the church even if they were from a very poor background. But the idea we have today where, say, you can start off very poor and save a lot of money and then be successful in business, you get to be rich, that wasn't as well thought of. But in the 16th century was a time of economic prosperity and people became more favorable to business. And Cajetan, in particular, rejected the view that people should just stay where they are where they were born. He thought it's perfectly all right if you want to rise to a higher position. And also he thought foreign exchange, where you trade one money for another kind of money, is all right. And this had been something the church had frowned on. The church didn't like foreign exchange. You remember in the New Testament, the famous incident where Christ goes into the temple and drives the money changers out. Well, what is a money changer? The money changers in the New Testament were people who exchanged foreign coins for the currency that you needed to make a contribution for the sacrifice in the temple. So these money changers were people engaged in foreign exchange. So if you went by that in the New Testament, you would think that foreign exchange really isn't such a good thing. You wouldn't have to think that. You might think that, and some people did, but Cajetan said, no, foreign exchange is a good activity. Now, in fact, in economics, his contributions to the theory of money were the most important aspect of his work in economics. Now, as everybody knows, and people really knew this before, just learning economic theory, people knew in a general way, that the price of a good is determined by its supply and demand. Say, people just know this in kind of common sense way. Supposing, say, people just start producing more apples and growing more apples, then, you know, the price of apples, I think, being equal is going to go down because there are more of them available. That will make the price go down. And on the other hand, if people, say, start to demand apples, more people really want more and more apples, then the price is going up. So people knew this in the way, even before economic theory was really developed, people had this, I mean, wasn't a big news that the price of goods is determined by supply and demand. The whole point of economics is go more deeply and say, well, what determines supply and demand? But the fact that the price of a good was determined by supply and demand, everybody knew that. Now, what Cajetan realized was that this applies to money too. One of the big problems in economics, and this again is a theme in Rothbard's history, is that economists tended to think of money as something separate from all the other goods. They said, well, we can have a theory of how prices of other goods are determined, what the value of other goods is, but money is a separate commodity, so that has a different explanation. So people would say, even if the price of good is determined by supply and demand, well, that is might be different for money. But Cajetan realized that money is a commodity. Money is a good just like other goods. And one of the basic points of Austrian economics, it tries to apply the same principles of apply to other goods to money as well. So money is treated pretty much as a regular commodity, even though it has special features. So Cajetan realized price of goods is determined by supply and demand. So he went further and he said, well, what will determine how much, say, demand and supply, you know, money will, the price of money is determined by demand and supply. So what will determine the demand and supply? Well, in part, that will depend on what people think demand and supply will be in the future. So, say, when you're thinking, well, how much money you want now, that will depend on, to some extent, how much money you'll think will be available in the future, what you think your future demand for money will be. And so this makes Cajetan a pioneer in the theory of expectation. I see somebody in the chat, Fernando, said, drew distinction. He said, well, didn't Rothbard say he's the founder rather than just a pioneer? Well, I wasn't intending a difference from Rothbard, just I intend that just as another way of phrasing the point, but I'm not intending any difference of opinion from Rothbard there. At least the important thing is just he was really the first one who really worked on expectations. Now, as commercial society was developing, you know, Spain was a big economic power in the 16th century, and really the economy was developing. People had a need to have more investments, and people wanted to invest, so they need to get money in order to invest, and in order to do that, they had to have, say, people who would be willing to lend the money. In order to get people to lend money, well, you have to usually pay some kind of premium. If I went to the bank and said, I need $50,000, say the banker won't give me $50,000, I just say, you know, if you give me this, I'll pay you the same money back, say, 6 months from now. I have to pay even more, I have to pay interest. So the problem was, though, as I mentioned in the last lecture, the church frowned on interest. The church said interest on money loans is really not a good thing. It's really wrong to do this. They would make some exceptions to that. There would be some ways you could get around this prohibition. But because people had a need for more money, there was a tendency to be more liberal about allowing interest. There was a tendency for people to come up with more and more justification. Now, to relate this to what I said a little bit earlier about the way scholastic philosophy proceeds, a scholastic philosopher wouldn't say something like, well, here's a new argument showing there's nothing wrong with interest. Say, we might imagine if somebody said, well, look, we have all these arguments saying interest is immoral or interest is prohibited by the New Testament, but really interest is perfectly all right. That wouldn't be a typically scholastic way of proceeding. A scholastic way of proceeding would be something like, well, okay, let's take the prohibition, maybe we can kind of tweak it a little or change it around a little so we can have more cases that allow interest. And there's a parallel here with a kind of Jewish approach to certain legal questions. You know, Raymond asked me about this in the last lecture. Say, for example, in Jewish law, find that the Old Testament, say, there's a requirement that every 7 years the land has to be rested for a year. So there'd be ways, so rather than saying, well, if we do that today, it would really be extremely bad for farming business, people just have to not grow anything for a year. So there are ways of getting around this prohibition, say they sell the land to someone who is Jewish, so they get around it. So you have various ways of getting around the prohibition. So this is very similar to what the scholastic view is about. We have these prohibitions against interest, but maybe we can get around them. And Cajetan falls into this pattern that he allows some cases of interest by modifying some of the older arguments. Now, one of the standard justifications for interest was called lucrum cessans, or cessans, however you want to pronounce. So what this is something like means lost profits. So what this means is, supposing, let's say, this would be very much contrary to fact, let's say I had $50,000 and you asked me for a loan of $50,000. Now, I can't say just right away, you have to pay me back more than $50,000 for me to be willing to give you that. But I could say, well, if I didn't lend you the money, then I could invest it in something and I would have earned a return, because they're not, remember, the scholastics aren't opposed to people making a profit on an investment, they're just opposed to loans, so getting interest on a loan. So I could say I can be compensated for the profit I'm giving up. So that's all right. So I'm not getting a direct fee for the loan. It's just you're not really paying me interest. What you're paying me for is the profit I lost. Like, I'll give you just one parallel again from Jewish law. This is on my mind because I have to give in early March a lecture on Judaism and capitalism. Say, there is a prohibition, say, on earning money through teaching the doctrines of the Torah, which is the first five books of the Bible. You can't earn money on that. So that would put rabbis out of business. So how do they get around that? Well, they say, they're being compensated for work that they otherwise would have done were they not teaching. So they're not really getting paid directly for their teaching. They're getting paid for what they would have, for compensation for what they otherwise would have earned. This is similar to this lucrum cessans. You're getting paid for what you would have earned. Now, Cajetan thought this would legitimize all business loans, but he wouldn't extend it to consumer loans. He wouldn't say you could lend money to a consumer, even if you would have lost money on, even if you would otherwise made a profit on what you would have invested. You might say, well, why not? And one of the things we'll find is, you might say, well, isn't it just the next step? You know, if you're lending to a consumer, the lender would still be losing a profit opportunity. But we'll see, it's very often difficult to take a logical next step. People very often miss what the next step is. And one of the ways that economics progresses or other sciences progresses, just seeing the next step, which once you take it, it seems obvious, but it isn't so obvious to people at times. So Cajetan didn't realize that his same argument would apply to consumer loans, or if he did think it would, if he rejected that extension. Now I want to get more directly to the school of Salamanca. I remember Spain was the greatest European power in the 16th century. Just an example, I'm sure you've all familiar with the famous battle of 1588, the battle of the Spanish Armada, where the British defeated the Spanish fleet. Now, remember though, at that time, England was just a quite minor power. They defeated the Spanish attempts at invasion, but that didn't make England anything like Spain in its comparable power. Spain was the major power. I see a question, Scholastic is trying to reconcile two possible, wouldn't it make sense to try to deduce the correct one? Well, that wasn't the way they proceeded. They would go from the arguments they had and make comments on them. And they would just say, well, we have this prohibition of interest, maybe there's various ways we can get around it. So remember, again, back to Spain, say it's the greatest European power in the 16th century. And remember, just as a sidelight on the Spanish Armada, you could ask, well, who was the victor in the war in which the Spanish Armada was a battle? It was actually, if you look at the war didn't end until 1620, in the peace treaty, Spain really did somewhat better than in, so even the Spanish Armada wasn't really a full loss. It wasn't a loss in the war. It didn't mean Spain lost that war. So at the University of Salamanca, because Spain was the greatest European power, it became and the world center for the study of economics. This was the most important place in the world at that time for studying economics. The founder of the school was Francisco de Vitoria, who was with 1485 to 1546, and he was best known as a great legal theorist. And he was famous for as an advocate of natural law, and he denounced the conquest and enslavement of the Indians in Spanish America. I should say here, there's a dissenting view by the great and very controversial legal theory, 20th century German legal theorist Carl Schmitt, who wrote about Victoria in a book called The Nomos of the Earth, which is kind of a study of the development of the public law of Europe, international law of Europe. And he thought, he has a different interpretation from Rothbard. I just mentioned this in passing. You can look this, read his book if you want to compare what he says with Rothbard. He thinks that although Victoria generally opposed wars of conquest, he thought that the Spanish, when they were fighting the Indians in Spanish America, were really making a justified response to attacks on them. So he has a different interpretation of Victoria. Now, Victoria made some important contributions to economic theory. I remember from the previous lecture, I said the usual view in the Middle Ages was that the just price, I mean, what is the price that morality requires, what is the just price? It's the prevailing market price. So say there's a market for apples in which one apple exchanges for one orange. That would be the just price for apples, just because that's the prevailing market price. Now the question, obvious question is, well, what if there isn't a prevailing market price? Supposing, say, I throw some paint on a wall, I said, oh, I've just produced this beautiful painting, I want the $20,000 for this beautiful painting I've just made. Well, there isn't a market for my paintings, fortunately, for the world of art. So what would be the just price there? There isn't a prevailing market price. So Victoria said that whatever the traders agreed on was just, say, if I could get anyone who was foolish enough to pay me $20,000 for my painting, then that would be the just price. Probably I couldn't get more than a penny or two with that. So that would be the just price. It would be whatever the traders agreed on. Now you might think that, well, isn't this an obvious next step? And just the example of the point I was making before about how difficult it is to see, somehow see the obvious next step. Because if we say the just price is the prevailing market price, well, isn't the reason for that that the market price is really what the buyers and sellers have agreed on? So if you say, well, the just price is what the buyers and sellers agreed on, wouldn't we say that would just, that would still apply, say, if there's just one buyer and one seller? Don't we have the same principle? It's what the people are agreeing on is making the price the just price. Well, it seems like an obvious next step, but as I say, it's sometimes very difficult to see what the obvious next step is. And in fact, Victoria didn't extend this view to all goods. He just said this is true for luxury goods. Say if there's a market for, if there are people trying to sell a luxury good, then it's whatever people agree on will be the just price. But if for non-luxury goods, he wasn't willing to say that. Now, another person that Rothbard thinks is very important is one of Victoria's students who has the rather unusual name, Martin Vasco Quetta Navarez, who lived from 1493 to 1586, which is, as you'll see, is quite a long time, 93 years. And he went first, this is one thing Rothbard is especially favorable to him because he went further than anyone else before in his defense of a free market. He opposed all government price fixing. He said if goods were abundant, then price controls don't do anything. Say, supposing if what's the point of saying that if you have a price control, say the goods are abundant, then the price will be below the, say we say, well, we have to have a maximum price because we don't on a certain good. If we have enough of the good, the price will be below that. But what if a good is scarce? Oh, someone says, well, there's an oil shortage, so we have to have a price limits on gasoline, because otherwise all these gasoline station owners will try price gouging and they'll get excess profits from these people who want to drive their cars who have to pay big amounts for gasoline. So, of course, Ethel Clutcher didn't use this example, but what he would point out would be, well, if the goods are really scarce, then controls are just going to cause harm because they'll just, people, if you have an artificially low price, then there'll be a shortage of the good. A lot of people, more people will want the good than there will be an amount of the good available. So the price controls won't help people, won't help everybody because they'll just make it harder for everybody to get the goods as opposed to all government price fixes. Now, his most, Ethel Clutcher's most important contributions to economics are in the theory of money. Now, like Cajetan, he realized that money is a commodity. As I mentioned before, this is one of the basic points in Austrian economics. It's one of the points where Austrian economics is really different from some of the other schools where other types of economics, segregate monetary theory from the rest of economic theory. And one of the great contributions of Austrian, I think probably von Mises was the most important person to really develop this fully, was that monetary theory has to be integrated into general utility theory. So Ethel Crutcher realized that the value of money determined the same way as value of other commodities. And one thing in applying this, remember, if we know in general, if a good supply increases, its prices fall, its price will fall. Say, an example I gave before, if the supply of apples increases, then other things being equal, the price of apples will fall. So what happens if we apply the same point to money? This will get what's called the quantity theory of money. If the quantity of money increases, and of course in Spain in the 16th century, the quantity of money was increasing, but gold and silver was being imported into the country from Spanish America, from all the colonies were getting big shipments of gold and silver. So we would say if a good supply increases, the price will fall. What do we mean by a fall in the price of money? A fall in the price, well, remember, you exchange money against all other goods. Every exchange in a money economy, except for barley, will be a certain amount of money against other amount of goods. So a fall in the price of money is equivalent to a rise in the price of everything else. So we get from quantity theory of money, if the quantity of money increases, then the prices will tend to go up. Increased quantity of money is inflation. It will increase prices. Now, unlike some later quantity theorists, Ethel Crutcher realized also demand was important in terms of the value of money. Say if people increase their demand for money, then the value of money will fall and prices will rise. If people want to hold more money, then units of money will be more valuable and prices will fall. So Ethel Crutcher used the quantity theory of money to explain the rapid increases in prices in Spain's 16th century. He said this rise was caused by shipments of gold and silver into the country. So it's saying it's just like in any other good, if the supply of the good increases, the price of the good will fall. Well, what is a fall in the price of money means a rise in prices of everything else. So if you have increase in quantity of money, will mean prices of everything other than money will go up. Right? Rothbard points out the usual person who's supposed to have originated this quantity theory of money is Jean Bodin, who was a French political theorist who lived around 1430 or 1429 to 1596. I would say the name Bodin is rather, I take some interest in Bodin because I wrote a PhD thesis on Bodin, not on his theory of money, but he's one that I one time studied to some extent. Of course, I've forgotten everything I knew about Bodin because it was so long ago that I studied him, but I'm naturally interested in when anyone mentions Bodin. But Rothbard said Bodin shouldn't get credit for originating the quantity theory of money. It was really Ethel Crutcher. Another key concept that Ethel Crutcher had was time preference. What do we mean by time preference? Well, supposing I offer you a choice between, say, $1,000 today and $1,000 a year from now, which would you take, other things being equal? Well, you would presumably take the money now because a good now is more valuable than one in the future. Sometimes, say, there are people who have different rates of preferring the present to the future. Say, with children, for example, tend to be they have very high rates of time preference. For example, if you say to, say, a five-year-old, you can have either an ice cream cone today or three ice cream cones if you wait till tomorrow. There are very few five-year-olds who say, well, we'll wait till tomorrow. So some people have very high rates of time preference, but everyone, other things being equal, will prefer good now to good in the future. And in the Austrian view, this is the real basis for having a rate of interest. Remember, say, if you have a loan in money, you'd say, well, why do you have to pay interest? Because, say, I lend you $1,000, why do you have to pay me interest? Because, well, when you give me $1,000 6 months from now, that isn't worth as much as $1,000. Now I'm giving you $1,000 now as a higher value good than $1,000 6 months from now. But again, this is a logical next step, but Aristocles didn't take that. He didn't take the step of using time preference to justify interest. I see the question, wouldn't prices rise as the value of money increases? No. See, the value of money increases. That means each unit of money is worth more. So the prices of everything else will fall. Say, if money is worth more, that means, remember, money is traded for everything else, so that means everything else, if money's worth more, you can get more of everything else with the same amount of money, so that would mean a fall in the price of everything else. If prices are rising, that means money isn't worth as much. Now, another of the scholastics that Rother discusses is Juan de Medina, and he lived from 1490 to 1546. And again, as we've seen before, one of the key topics is that how do we justify interest? I think Fernando has a question here. Maybe I'd better wait till the question period to do. Let me just take a quick look at this, see if I want to wait. So, I'll deal with that, your question, later on. It's an interesting question. I think I'd better deal with that later on. Okay, so what Medina said, again, this is something that seems like an obvious step, but he was the first one to make it. Say, why would you ask for interest on a loan? Why would you ask for a premium if you're going to lend someone money? Well, one justification for asking for a premium is that if you lend somebody money, you're taking a risk that the person isn't going to pay you back. Say, supposing somebody lent me $1,000. Well, they probably wouldn't know this, but of course you're not going to get the money back from me. I'm certainly not going to pay back money. So the person's going to lose his money. So if he knew that, he wouldn't give me the money, but he would know there's at least some chance he's not going to get the money back. So Medina said, well, being willing to put your money at risk is a service that can be purchased, so that's one justification for interest. So, I misspelled his name. Medina didn't think this argument applied to riskless loans, but his opponents, and he had a lot of opponents, said, well, if you put this in, then really you'd be justifying interest on practically all loans, because practically any loan would involve some risk that you're going to lose your money. So Medina had really opened the floodgates with this argument, although he didn't fully realize it. If you allow a premium for risk, then you really just find interest in practically everything. Now, Rothbard, these were people I discussed so far, Franklin Ketchum, members of the, Rothbard calls that the early Salamanca school. Now there's a middle period, I'm not going to say too much about that, but the middle years included figures that he discusses in some detail, Covarrubias, Saravia, and Mercado. And this group opposed cost production theories of value and claimed that the value of goods is determined by utility and scarcity. So of course, Rothbard is going to think very highly of them, because remember, as I said, one of the key themes that he had is that the value of goods is determined by people's preferences, by their utility, and they're not by the cost of production. So he says these are important pioneers in developing that view. And they also, again, like some of the figures we talked about before, like Kajic and Pascal Quetta, apply this analysis to money. So the value of money, just like those other goods, would depend on how scarce it is and on how much people demanded it. So their views are quite similar to the views of those we've already discussed. That's why I'm not going to say much about them. Now, the next person I do want to say a little bit more about, because I actually wrote an article on one of the points that I'll be talking about. Luis de Molina, who lived from 1535 to 1601, was one of the most important of the last generation of the school of Salamanca. Well, he attended Salamanca only briefly, still considered a member of the school. Now, Robert points out that he strongly favored free will, and I want to go into that a little bit in detail, because I wrote an article on this point with my friend Father James Sadowski. So what Molina was most famous for, his doctrine was called scientia media, or middle knowledge. So what Molina was trying to answer was an interesting question. He said, well, God knows everything. God is omniscient, but human beings have free will. So how can God know what we're going to choose in future if it's completely up to us to decide what we're going to do in future? How can God know that? Now, there are various attempts to answer that question, but what Molina thought was, well, God knows what we would freely choose in every possible set of circumstances. You know, say, what you would do in such and such circumstances, you would freely choose to do this, or other circumstances, you would choose to do that. So he knows what each person would freely decide to do in every possible set of circumstances. That's the middle knowledge. He knows what he would do in all these circumstances. Then, because he knows this thing, then he can decide which circumstances he wants to create. He says, well, if I created such and such a world, people would freely choose to do these things. So what's the one I think would be best to create? And he's going to create that. So he knows what you're going to freely choose in each possible set of circumstances, then just creates the set of circumstances that he wants. So he knows what you're going to do even though you freely choose it. Now the big counter to that is something like, it doesn't make sense to say what you will freely choose in a particular set of circumstances. So that's what the opponents of middle knowledge said. That was the argument that Father Sadowski and I advanced against middle knowledge. Now, as Rothbard mentioned, Molina had an important dispute with Dominican, Domingo de Banez, who was one of the most famous followers of St. Thomas Aquinas. Molina was a Jesuit, and he was fighting against Dominican. Dominicans and Jesuits are very often at odds with each other. Rothbard doesn't cover dispute in detail, but what Banyas thought, in contrast to Molina, remember, says that God knows what we would choose in any pot, what we freely choose in any possible circumstance. Banyas claimed that God causes us to do things freely. So it's God, we're doing things freely, but at the same time, we have free will, but God is still bringing it about that we act as we do. And the big argument against him is that that's a contradiction. So this is a big controversy, one of the most important controversies of the late Scholastic period between Banyas and Molina on free will. Now, in economics, Molina continued the Salamancan analysis of money, remember, where money is considered just as a commodity, just like all other commodities. And he's the first to introduce into economics ceteris paribus clauses. Now, this means other things being equal. So what do we mean by that? That would say, suppose I say, as I said before, if the supply of apples increases and price of apples will go down. Well, that won't always be true because, let's say, supply of apples increases, but people at the same time have a big increase in their demand for apples, then the price might not go down. But what we can say is, other things being equal, holding everything else constant, if the supply of apples increases, the price will go down. So this is very important. Economists are always talking about ceteris paribus, and Molina was the one who introduced that. And another thing was he strongly favored freedom of monetary exchange. He said, it's a good thing, just like some of the earlier people from Salamanca said, it's a good thing if you can exchange one money for another, because this is just a way of adjusting demand and supply, just as you would say, people should be free to trade, kind of, so we could alleviate shortages and surpluses. This is true for money, too. Money should be able to flow to where it's most in demand. So if there's a lot of money in Spain, then it's all right. Then money will be exported to other countries where it's more in demand, where there's more of a shortage in money. And one thing, remember, one thing in Rothbard's book, again, he's not concerned strictly with economics, kind of shut off everything else. One thing that I think is one of the great features of the book is that he brings in all sorts of developments in philosophy, theology, other fields. And he mentions in political theory, one of Molina's important contributions was he had followed what Rothbard calls following Richard Tuck, an active conception of right. If you have a right, then you have a power to do something. Say, if you have a property right, means you have the power to use the property. So this is a very important concept. It's used in some of the later theories by Locke and some of the later libertarian theories, that right involves an active power, control over something, especially with property. It was something that Molina was stressing. Now, another important scholastic was Juan de Mariani, who lived from 1536 to 1624. He was a very strong personality, and he published a famous pamphlet where he opposed the debasement of copper coinage by King Philip III of Spain. Was debasing coinage. Well, when, say, that you had a metallic coin, the coins would be, say, they'd wear out after a while, and people would take them back to be reminted. So when they were doing that, they would sometimes put in less of the metal than was in the original coin. So say the coin was supposed to have a certain amount of copper, maybe less of the amount of copper, and they put in some less valuable metal in with it. So the same amount of copper would be spread out of onto more coins. So debasement increases the supply of money. It's a kind of inflation. let's say, because the same amount of copper would be going into more coin. So inflation, Mariana points out, is really a hidden tax. Say, if you have, always the government said, well, you have to pay 10% of your copper coins to the king. That would be, wouldn't be a hidden tax. You'd know it's a tax. But say if the, instead of doing that, when you brought your coins for reminting, they just took 10% of the copper out, that would be a similar tax, but you would probably wouldn't be aware of it. So Mariana said inflation is a hidden tax. And he argued, and here he had a lot of precedent in the medieval legal understanding, the king has no right to impose a new tax without the consent of the people. And he also, on same grounds, are saying, okay, not only can't the king impose a tax in the sense of a kind of direct tax, like in the ordinary understanding, but he can't debase the coinage because this is a hidden tax. And he said, the king can't grant a monopoly to a particular seller if, say, this monopoly would charge a higher price than the market would have, because that's also a type of tax. Now, what if the king does that? Well, then Mariana was willing to say that you could get rid of the king, you could kill the king. So naturally, Philip III wasn't very happy when his pamphlet came out, and he tried to put Mariana in prison, although he eventually got out, and he tried to buy up all the copies of his pamphlet so people wouldn't read it, and it became very rare. In France, this notion of tyrannicide was very, people were very, thought very badly about the government, because some kings were actually killed, and some people appealed to Mariana on tyrannicide, so the French authorities weren't very happy about this. Now, the last person we're going to discuss is Leonard Lessius. He was Flemish, not Spanish, but Rothbard considers him a Salamancan in spirit. And you can see from his name, he's Belgian, because Lessius means is a Latin way of saying from Liège, which is a city in Belgium. So you can just say from the name that he's Belgian. So his big contribution was, remember, in the scholastic view, the just price is the prevailing market price. And again, we've seen this problem. We can see certain things are kind of obvious extension of the view that we have, but people find it difficult to see what the obvious extension is. Well, the obvious extension is this applies to wages also, because a wage is the price of labor. So the just price would be what the prevailing market wage is. So this is what Lessius realized, that the just wage is the market wage. So if somebody says, well, a certain wage is unjust because it's too low, then Lessius says, look, it isn't unjust, because the fact that people are willing to work at the wage shows that they're agreeing to accept that, and what the just wage is what people have agreed to accept. So you can't say the market wage is, rightly say the market wage is too low. And he also, Lessius also had a very important notion of the Austrians call psychic income. This doesn't mean you make income as a fortune teller reading tarot cards. It means some jobs have non-monetary compensation as part of wages. Supposing, say, some college professors like teaching or doing research, so they're liking that as part of the compensation they're getting. Maybe they could get a higher paying job in some other field that they don't like, but when you take kind of a psychic compensation, psychic income, it would be more profitable for them to work as college professors, given their their preferences. So as I say, there's a lot, there are many people we haven't been able to cover in this chapter and other chapters, but what I try to do in this lecture is give you some idea of some of the contributions of the important Spanish scholastic. So I think we'll we'll finish now, and we can go into questions. Now, I first want to do, I think, before I go to the Q&A, Fernando had a question that I wanted to address that he put in the chat, if I can see this, then we'll go to the Q&A. He wanted to know, is Fernando wanted to ask about whether it's still against the banking business, understood as serving the middleman between suppliers of funds, and can we trace his kind of proto-argument in favor of 100% reserve system in banking, assuming that fractional reserve tends to create money from nowhere? That's an interesting question. Well, I don't think Asselquater is saying you can't create money from nowhere. I don't think he takes a view on that. He's just saying you can't, there are limits to when you can get take, he's considering when you can take interest. And the justification, one justification he considered is if you're foregoing a profit opportunity. So that wouldn't directly, I think, imply any position on whether it's all right to create money the way fractional reserve banking does. So let me now, I'll now go to the Q&A, and if you have questions, please type them in, and I'll try to answer them or evade them. Charles wants to know, what is a good argument for why Chiefs got mad at the money change? I think the usual view is that they were one argument is you weren't supposed to do business in the temple, and the other is that they were charging a lot of money for their services in foreign exchange, that their rates were, Jesus thought they were asking too much. But I think the usual view is that they weren't supposed to be doing business there, and he kicked them out. Fernando says, does the Scholastic have any particular opinion about the use of paper money, or is it payment through that? I don't think they address that in any real detail. I mean, paper money wasn't in it. I mean, there were bills of payment, but I mean, paper money wasn't in as much use as we have it today. So I don't think that's one they considered in any detail. At least Rothbard doesn't discuss that much. That was something that really came, that was an issue that really came in later. Let's see if anyone has anything in the chat also. No. Okay. Justin says, Rothbard seems somewhat soft on Scholastic tactics of evasion and usury prohibition. Do you think he would have treated his school of thought he was unsympathetic with as kindly? I think here when you're saying evasion, that's really assuming that they're doing something tricky or wrong. But what the Scholastics were doing was trying to see how this usury prohibition should be interpreted. So I think let me phrase it this way. I think if it were the case, supposing, now of course Rothbard is opposed to the usury prohibition, so maybe you take your question this way, I wasn't really understanding, maybe you could take it this way. Supposing there was some prohibition that Rothbard favored, let's say there was a ban on government price fixing, and you had a school of economists who were trying to come up with ways you could get around that, so ways you could fix prices, even though we have this general prohibition of doing it, then I think Rothbard wouldn't be very sympathetic to that. So I think he's sympathetic to what they were doing because he thinks the usury prohibition was wrong. So he would say they're doing a good thing in trying to come up with exceptions to it. So I don't think there's some general point where we can say trying to get a prohibition around a prohibition is evasion, and evasion is a bad thing, whatever the nature of the prohibition is. So I think it would depend on what you thought of a prohibition to begin with. Now Matthew asked a question, did need to take a traditional view of economics, starting with Smith, the giving knowledge to groups, the contribution of group by groups such as Blackett. Well, Mises addressed this question. You know, the Henry Regnery Company issued a paperback, a kind of abridged edition of Wealth of Nations, had a preface by Mises. What Mises said in this was Smith really was summing up a lot of earlier contributions rather than making an original contribution himself. So Mises was really pretty much in sympathetic to the kind of view that Rothbard is advancing, although he didn't write about the medieval period too much. Of course, Mises would have known the great work of Joseph Schumpeter, History of Economic Analysis, that is also stressing the medieval contributions that downplays the originality of Adam Smith. So I think Mises would have been sympathetic to what Rothbard was doing. Now Bob asked, is there a danger of trying to find Austrian under every rock with some ancient era? Are the proto-Austrians quite clear in the original writing of time? Some of this seems wonderful, but almost too good to be true. Well, I see what that's a very interesting question. Now, what you're suggesting is really kind of a version of this view I was suggesting when I said there's a kind of a Whig interpretation that Rothbard is accepting. You know, he still recognizes that, well, we have Austrian economics is the correct view, and we're interested in what leads up to that. And I said he's rejecting the view that each period has sort of a separate theory that really can't be compared with each other. So what you suggested, well, what if the Scholastics really weren't coming up with proto-Austrian concepts? Maybe they had a kind of a world of thought of their own. Maybe is Rothbard just reading into these people what leads up to his own views? Well, I mean, that would be something to look out for, but I don't think we could come up with an a priori argument that that must be the case. I think we would just have to look at these writers and say, is Rothbard correct in what he says about this? I think you're right, there is a danger of doing that, but whether that Rothbard has succumbed to such a danger would be another question. I mean, I think he does seem to make a pretty convincing case from his quotations that he's interpreting them correctly. So I think you're raising a good point, but that isn't to say that Rothbard is vulnerable to the charge you're suggesting, but it is a good thing that one should bear in mind in reading him. It's an excellent point. Jessica, I was just surprised he never took them to task for not attacking prohibition outright, and even seemed critical of secularists for making that criticism. Well, you see, if you said they should have attacked the prohibition outright, then you'd want to know why. I mean, from their point of view, they were going according to what the authorities of the church said. I mean, for them to attack the prohibition outright, they would have to be saying the church is completely wrong about things, and that would have been very difficult for them to do. And I mean, I think when he criticizes secularists, I think he's not criticizing them for saying that interest is all right, but I think he thinks that secularists tend unreasonably to reject the assumptions of the scholastics. Rothbard himself was not a believer, but he took the scholastic views very seriously, so I think he thought that would have been really unrealistic to expect them to adopt this later view, but from where they were, their criticisms of the prohibition were good ones. Now, Patricia says, what important experiences do you think the Spanish economists gathered from the colonial years in America and Asia? The same thing for Portuguese and Dutch economists. All these nations had major colonial possessions. Well, I think one of the contributions was just in studying the effect of money, the increases in money that I brought out in the lecture. Now, I think I think, at least from the way Rothbard describes it, that the colonial experience had any real direct effect on their economic theories other than studying money. They did in with Victoria, you had a discussion, this was more legal theory, on what the status of the subjects was, led to important questions of legal theory. But I think it's really in later periods of economics that you would have economists studying the effect of colonies and theories of imperialism. That would come in really later. Now, Leslie says, how stifling on economic privacy in the Middle Ages with the prohibition on interest? Did European economists start to progress because merchants found ways of getting around the prohibition? Would the Thomist scholastics? I don't see the rest of that. Well, I think it had some role. I mean, you need capital investment, and capital investment people usually aren't willing to lend money unless they can get something back for it. So, and I mean, though people did get interest in the Middle Ages, it was just going against the church law, but it took place anyway. So I would think it had some effect in retarding progress. I mean, how much would be difficult to say. But I mean, I think you're right that that was an important factor. When I see something on Leslie's question, would the Thomas Glass have already been into the prohibition and not been ignored so much? Well, I think that probably led them to think of justifications for interest, but I mean, they might have considered that anyway just out of theoretical interest. I mean, people say when the scholastics would very often raise possibilities that weren't actually the case in practice just because of theoretical interest. So they might have raised the question anyway. Now, Charles says, interest is determined by time press. Got me wrong. The lender is lending out the future value of the good, and the interest is the present value minus the future value. No, that isn't quite right. The lender is lending the present good. So when he does that, say, I'm lending you $1,000, so I'm giving you $1,000 now, and what I'm going to get back, say, is $1,000 6 months from now. So I'm lending you $1,000 now and I'm getting back $1,000 6 months ago. So interest comes in because $1,000 now is worth more than $1,000 6 months from now. Fernando says, I think one of the main disadvantages of this book, someone wants to study the man in more specific detail, is a lack of proper quoting. For example, in this chapter, he had barely four quotes at the end. Well, you see, I think your point is a good one, but remember two things. Remember, this book came out, it was published immediately after Rothbard died. Rothbard died January 1995. The book came out shortly after. So he didn't really have a chance to work on it, do all the final corrections. Then a further point is, remember, the book as we have it is extremely long. It's very small print. So if he put in a whole lot of quotations, it would have made the book much longer. I mean, he gives you summaries of all the writers he gives, but he doesn't give you all the sources he's used and all the quotations. I mean, that does, I think it might well have been good to include those. I mean, it would have made the book enormously longer. But you're right that that is a point. I mean, if you want to go into particular writers in much detail, you really have to get the writers themselves and study what, compare what Rothbard has said with their works. Jessica, what were the first records of currency debasement? That's a very good question. Unfortunately, I don't have an answer for you on that. I mean, I don't think the one that Mariani was discussing was the first one. I think currency debasement was known in the Roman Empire, but I don't know what the historical sources are on that. I have to look at one now. Can anyone have any questions on middle knowledge? That's a very interesting issue, I think. Doesn't have much to do with economics, but it is one of Molina's key most important contribution to philosophy. Oh, Justin, what do you think about the postmodernist views on middle knowledge? Well, I don't think the postmodernists are really written on that topic. I don't know of any postmodernists who address that. I'd be interested in one hand. Steve wants to know if anywhere we could read your article, middle knowledge. Well, yes, if you go to there's a website by Anthony Flood that has it. It came out in International Philosophical Quarterly, but I can try to get the link for you to that. It isn't that good an article, but at least for my part of it. Sadowski, of course, has a very fine philosopher, but it came out quite some years ago. I think it was in around 1983 or so, but it is on that website. I'll try to get a link for you if you'd like. Remind me of that, please. Oh, someone says there is a link. Oh, good. You put it up already. Oh, that's funny. See, I was hoping to avoid having to put up the link so people wouldn't read the article, but now I can't do that. Yes, it was a long time ago that I wrote that. I remember Sadowski gave me a card and said, well, what do you think of this argument? I said, it sounds good. He said, well, write it up then. Yes, and I it's funny, I had a call from Father Sadowski today. He's 89. He just had his lunch. I said, I bet I could tell you, guess what you had for dessert. With two scoops of chocolate ice cream. So he said, that's right. I said, do you have two scoops of chocolate ice cream after every lunch and dinner? He said, yes. See, because that middle knowledge is, well, probably middle would be expanding, but I don't know about the knowledge part. Oh, it's not middle, no, it's not middle knowledge on my part, because he's not a case of free will, because I'm just choosing according to his fixed preferences, so that wouldn't be free will. See, free will, in the way it taken this country, would be one where, say, you have, there's kind of equal considerations on each side or on various sides of the question, and the decision is purely a matter of your will, the kind of restricted notion of free will. If you have a case where, let's imagine these circumstances. Somebody's in tremendous pain, and then you say to the person, well, the person's offered some kind of relief for the pain, so they weren't going to accept it. Then you would be able to say, in those circumstances, the person would choose to have the medication. But that isn't the case, that isn't the kind of case we're considering in middle knowledge. We're considering middle knowledge is a kind of impossible certainty. You could say what the person would freely choose, or freely choose has this kind of restricted sense. So see, your question was it humorous, but it raised an extremely important point. I'm glad you said that. Well, now here's something. Let's see, Steve said, so he's free to have two or three, but because you forget the answer. Well, he's, in one sense, he's free to have many scoops as he wants. But see, given his preferences, his choosing to have two scoops isn't a case of a free will in this way we're using it in this controversy. Now, there's another complication here that I didn't want to raise, but since you, supposing we did have a case of free will, then on the view that Sadowski and I were defending, there's nothing wrong with knowing what someone will freely choose in the actual world. The issue is, can you know what someone would choose in some circumstances other than the actual world, and that's what is in question. But we argued in the article, it doesn't make sense to say what someone would have freely chosen in some circumstance other than the actual world. that now microservices is compatible. No, this isn't compatible. Is the view that determinism and free will are consistent with one another. But the issue here isn't one where determinism comes in, sort of we're assuming in this argument that determinism isn't true. We're talking about incompatibilist free will. And we're saying, does it make sense to say that there's a way the person would have freely chosen in that incompatibilist sense in every possible circumstance other than the actual world? So that compatibilism is a different issue. Okay, well, I guess, did anyone have any final question? I guess that's an interesting issue. So I guess we're about out of time, so I hope you haven't been upside down a bit off. You know, Rothbard does discuss philosophy and other topics, so that's why I thought just by mentioning this, so rather than just, I don't want to confine this strictly to economic theory, but that is, of course, the central thing in the lecture. So thanks, everybody, for coming to the lecture. Hope we'll see you all next week. Thanks a lot, everybody.